From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. May you be the mother of 100 sons is the traditional Hindu blessing given brides on their wedding day. Journalist Elizabeth Bumiller says it's just one example of women's low status in India. On this edition of Fresh Air, Elizabeth Bumiller on the women of India. Also today, we meet writer Walter Mosley. The hero of his first novel is a black private eye whose first case takes him into a hostile white world. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Benjamin Britten's operatic adaptation of The Turn of the Screw. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Another 48 Hours, starring Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NATO foreign ministers have ended a two-day meeting in Scotland with a call to cooperate with the Soviet Union to build a stable Europe, NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
We extend the hand of friendship and cooperation, NATO Secretary General Manfred Werner said today, to the Soviet Union and to all the nations of Europe. No longer are these states enemies, they are now partners, Werner said, in building the new Europe. NATO warmly endorsed the changes the Warsaw Pact has embarked on, in transforming itself from a military alliance to a democratic political organization of sovereign states. To encourage these trends, NATO has announced it will soon present new proposals in conventional arms reduction talks underway in Vienna. NATO hopes its new proposals will break the impasse in Vienna and lead to a treaty this year that will result in the dramatic reduction of forces throughout Central Europe. I'm Mike Schuster in London.
The new right-wing government formed today by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir is already drawing criticism for its hard-line policies on the Palestinian uprising and on Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. After a two-and-a-half-month deadlock, Shamir succeeded in winning the support of ultra-Orthodox religious parties to gain a two-vote majority in parliament. The new government's policy guidelines say it will act to strengthen, expand, and develop Jewish settlements in the occupied territories. Shamir's new government also pledged to uproot violence that's part of the Palestinian uprising. In Czechoslovakia today, it's the start of 2 days of voting in the first free elections in 44 years. Voters are expected to hand a resounding defeat to the Communist Party. Sylvia Pojoli reports from Prague.
Voters are electing deputies to the Federal Assembly and to the Czech and Slovak National Councils. Their choice is from among more than 3,000 candidates of 22 political parties. The new parliament will be in office for 2 years, and its main task will be to draft a new constitution. Polls show that the big winner will be Civic Forum, the opposition movement founded last December by Václav Havel, now the country's president. Civic Forum may even win an outright majority. The second largest party is expected to be the Christian Democrats, while the communists, which have dropped their hammer and sickle symbol for two red cherries, are likely to get less than 10%. In Prague, this is Sylvia Pojoli.
President Bush said today that he may break off talks with the Palestine Liberation Organization because of its involvement in an attempted terrorist attack on an Israeli beach resort. The president repeated his call for PLO leader Yasser Arafat to publicly condemn the attack and suggested that the U.S. may break off the dialogue with the PLO if his demand isn't met. Prices were sharply lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 35 points to close at 2,862.38 in moderate trading of 143 million shares. This is NPR News. The man who invented a so-called suicide machine has been ordered not to use it again until prosecutors decide whether he broke the law by helping an Alzheimer's disease victim take her own life. The temporary restraining order was issued against Dr. Jack Kevorkian, a retired pathologist who used his device in the first acknowledged medically assisted suicide in the United States. On Monday, Kevorkian connected Janet Adkins to his machine and showed her how to push a button that let a lethal chemical into her veins. Mrs. Adkins, who's 54, reportedly chose to take her own life rather than lose her mental faculties to Alzheimer's disease. Officials are saying the environmental damage following yesterday's major oil spill in New York Harbor is manageable. Don Matheson of member station WNYC has this report.
About 300 workers are on the scene today, cleaning up the mess left following yesterday's oil spill in a section of the harbor called the Kilvan Cull. Coast Guard spokeswoman Amy Wilkins says the spill occurred when a British tanker ran aground.
The resulting 30-foot by 14-inch rip in its number 4 starboard right tank allowed approximately 260,000 gallons of number 6 heavy oil to spill before the tank was offloaded.
30,000 feet of oil-containing booms have been deployed at the spill site. 5 ships and 7 vacuum trucks are busy in the mop-up operation. The Kilvan Coal Shipping Channel, one of the most heavily traveled in the world, remains closed to vessels. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
In response to safety concerns from some of the country's top nuclear weapons experts, Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has ordered the Air Force to remove short-range nuclear attack missiles from its bombers. The directors of 3 U.S. nuclear weapons laboratories called for the removal of the weapons during congressional testimony 2 weeks ago. They suggested that there is a remote possibility the missiles could leak plutonium in an accident. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Elizabeth Buemiller, says the story of women in India is one of paradoxes. Most of the 400 million women live in villages, where some are forced into an endless day of working in the fields and taking care of the home. Others follow the Islamic tradition of purdah and are not allowed to leave the house at all. Violence against women is common, and the birth of a daughter is considered a calamity. But on the other hand, India produced one of the most powerful female leaders in the world, Indira Gandhi. Elizabeth Buemiller lived in India from 1985 to 1988. She was a reporter for the Style section of the Washington Post when her husband, Stephen Weissman, was sent by the New York Times to cover India. Buemiller went along and began reporting from India for the Post. She's written a book titled May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, A Journey Among the Women of India. She writes about the women of the cities and the villages, powerless women, and the growing feminist movement. Buemiller writes that being in India changed her mind about feminism.
I think what it did was sort of reaffirmed or emphasized some sort of vague beliefs that I had before I left. Until I went to India, I had had sort of a conventional belief in feminism. I had been raised in the 1970s in Cincinnati, and I think I to a large extent reaped the benefits of the feminist movement in the 60s, and I naturally assumed I would have a profession. But I don't think my feminism went much beyond that, and I think after experiencing India and meeting all these women, I think my feminism took on a larger context. I think I saw that feminism is not just about the sort of self-absorbed determination to have a career of one's own.
Why did you start writing about women in India?
Well, I hadn't originally wanted to. I had been very self-conscious about going to India with my husband, so the wife sort of following her husband to India. And I had not wanted to write what I considered the predictable woman's book. About women in India, even though many people had suggested to me this would be a wonderful topic. But as I began reporting in India for the Washington Post, it was the stories that I wrote about women that touched me the deepest. The first year I was there, I met a woman who had been burned by her husband because she had not brought enough dowry to her marriage. And I met village women who touched me. I met young, educated women in the big cities who had arranged marriages and thought this was perfectly all right. So I felt that the women were my way into India, my way of understanding a very complicated, complex country.
I think it's difficult for an American woman, particularly an American feminist woman, to be in another culture that is not only not a feminist culture, but a culture where traditionally women are considered to be less valuable than men. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you project your values onto the society, or do you try to distance yourself and say, well, that's their culture, and who am I to pass judgment, and so on? Was this a big issue for you as you went around to cities and villages interviewing women?
Yes, it certainly was. I wrestled with it every day. I was very, very aware of my own cultural baggage, my own preconceptions, whatever you want to call it. I tried to understand what was going on in each situation. I tried to understand arranged marriages. I tried to understand the reasons for dowry. But And then, but then at the end, I felt that I had to judge because I had in a book, you know, you have to come to some conclusions. You can't, I couldn't just be, as I had been in the past, an unbiased reporter for the Washington Post. I had to come to some decisions. And so I did make judgments, and it'll be interesting to see what other Indian women think of those judgments.
My guest is Elizabeth Buemiller, who writes for The Washington Post, and she was in India for several years, and her new book is about women in India. It's called May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons. Now, the title of your book, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, that comes from a Hindu blessing for brides. Is it still considered a disaster to have a female child, to give birth to a girl?
Well, of course, not in all segments of society in India. Among the the upper middle class, among the very educated classes, girls are welcome. But I would say, in general, the birth of a boy is a joyous occasion, and a much more joyous occasion than the birth of a girl. And in many, many parts of society, the birth of a girl is viewed as a calamity still, certainly in villages and in rural India.
What makes having a girl a calamity?
Well, certainly right now, there's a lot of things, but the biggest issue right now in India is dowry. Dowry is, you know, the gifts and the cash that is that the bride's family has to give to the groom's family at the time of her wedding. And in India today, dowry has been escalating beyond all proportions to a family's ability to pay it. For instance, it's not unusual for a man who makes $800 a year to have to pay a dowry worth $3,000 for his daughter, and that includes, you know, a motorcycle, a refrigerator, a television set. This is the biggest problem right now. I think, you know, and there are many families who feel they simply cannot afford another girl. And if you ask, if you tell these families, yes, but why don't you just refuse to pay dowry? It's they feel it's just not an option, and that they will never marry off their daughter without it.
Do all women have dowries when they get married?
No, not all. I mean, again, among some of the elite, there is not dowry. These are very westernized, educated people who abhor a dowry and refuse to pay it. And then certainly among some lower castes in the villages, there is no dowry. It's not completely widespread. But what is significant is that it is spreading. Traditionally, dowry was the preserve of the upper castes, of the Brahmins in particular. But in recent years, it has been spreading to lower castes. And so, for instance, I was in a village in the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu, and I met, you know, farm laborers who said that they were now paying dowry, and it had only been in the last 5 years that they had to do that, because they had said that the rich people in town are paying it, and so we feel now that we must pay it, and it is being demanded of us before we can marry off our daughters.
Amniocentesis has made it possible for a pregnant woman to find out whether she's carrying a boy or a girl. And
yes.
There was, I know a few years ago in India, there was a lot of abortions of female fetuses. Is that
yes.
still going on?
Well, it was, I'm sure it is, but officially it was made illegal in 1988, right before I left. I had gone to Bombay in 1987, the spring of 87, and done some reporting. I had talked to women who had had used amniocentesis to determine whether or not the fetus they were carrying was a boy or a girl. And if the fetus was a girl, in most cases they would have the fetus aborted because they felt they could not, you know, afford the cost of another girl. This was happening at such in such alarming numbers in Bombay and in the states surrounding it that in 1988 the Maharashtra State Assembly, that state legislature, Maharashtra is the state of which Bombay is the capital, banned such a test. And when I left India, there was a discussion underway in New Delhi that there should be a nationwide ban as well. Anyway, it was made illegal in Maharashtra, but many doctors and feminists felt that it would just women would just go across the border into neighboring states and have it done there. But at least it was a deterrent.
What's the cultural explanation for the dowry?
Cultural explanation? Well, I think you could just say that when dowry... Well, there's two things at work here. One is that women are still largely viewed as chattel, as property, and therefore if you need to... as a liability in a family. Therefore, to get rid of the liability, to pass your daughter on to her in-laws' family, you have to pay them. You have to give them large amounts of money to take on take on your liability. But what's also at work, I think, is that there's among the middle class in India in the last decade, there has been an economic boom. The middle class is doing quite well. And dowry is now seen as a way of moving up on the economic scale. The dowries have become so large that a groom's family sees this as a great opportunity of increasing their wealth. And it's considered a very serious problem in India now, where materialism and a consumer boom has actually fueled dowry.
You mentioned earlier that one of the things that troubled you was all the arranged marriages that you saw in India.
I don't know if it troubles me. I don't think it's a good idea for all of us, but for Americans. I went into it with an open mind, feeling that in India, where in the upper middle classes, where young women are not allowed to date, they don't have much chance to meet men before they're married, the new kind of arranged marriage that does exist, where a woman's family goes out and looks actively for a possible husband, finds one, presents him to the woman, and then they go out, say, for 6 months and see whether it takes. And the woman has the right to say no. I don't think this is so horrible. But I don't think arranged marriage is the most serious problem, certainly, of Indian women. I just think it's more of a symptom of a society that views women as property.
When you spend time with couples whose marriages were arranged, could you feel any difference? Did it seem any different than American couples who loved each other very much, at least when they got married?
Well, it's hard. It's very hard to know what's going on in someone else's marriage. I certainly wouldn't want to tell you. But among some of our friends in India, I felt that some of the marriages that had been sort of semi-arranged, I felt that the couples sometimes didn't seem as if they were friends. It was more the marriage is more of a social construct. It was a marriage between two families of common background. And I didn't feel that they were looking for the closeness that we strive for in our marriages under the best circumstances. Don't always find, but which we consider an ideal.
When you spoke to both men and women who were in arranged marriages, did they defend the practice?
Oh, certainly. They felt that, and it was very interesting, they felt that arranged marriages did work. They felt that Americans had it all wrong, and they often pointed to our divorce rate as evidence of this. They said that, in their view, Americans view love as passion. We view true love as passion, which inevitably wears off after the first 3 or 4 years, and then we're stuck with each other, and of course then we become very disappointed and we get divorced. That was their view of American marriage. In their view, what they do in India is that, they have a set of parents who have the foresight to find a suitable groom for a daughter. And so then the first few years, there's a great deal of passion, as in any new relationship. But then when that passion wears off, as is inevitable, it's very fortunate that there were parents around who had the intelligence and the wisdom to find two people who had some compatibility and who had common interests. That, in their view, is... And then they feel also that after those first few years, this is when true love sets in, that the true love, which is commitment to family, devotion, loyalty... this can only happen after marriage, not before.
Okay, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Elizabeth Buemiller. She writes for The Washington Post. She lived in and reported from India from 1985 to 1988, and she will soon be returning to Japan, where she has been living lately and writing from. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. She's the author of a new book called May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, A Journey Among the Women of India. Elizabeth, you spent time with women in the high caste, the highest caste, and women who are poor. You spent time in the cities, time in the villages. Are the issues in the feminist movement different in different parts of India and among different castes of women?
Yes, they are. The women's movement in India, which, without making it too complicated, is, the current women's movement in India has its basis in improving the lives of rural women, I would say, of village women. But that's a very difficult task, especially when the leaders of the women's movement are women from the large cities, from educated elite families. So rather than within the American women's movement, where the leaders of the movement sort of took the concerns of their own lives, of their personal concerns, and made them political, to paraphrase Gloria Steinem, the leaders of the women's movement in India have had to understand the problems of women who are enormously different from them, and before they can move forward. So there's a different impulse in India, I think. And it is the movement has borrowed some from Western feminism, but it doesn't completely translate.
Mm-hmm. Can you briefly give us a sense of what the different issues are in the city and in rural communities for women in India?
Well, in the villages, the issues are fuel, fodder, and water, to use a phrase that was used over and over again. Women aren't so much concerned with their rights as they are with getting enough water and having it close enough to their home so they don't have to walk an hour a day just for a pail of water they can carry on their heads. They need to have access to good, suitable grasses for their cows to eat. And they need to have access also to some sort of fuel so they can cook the meals for the family. It's there's survival issues in the villages. In the cities, of course, the issues are more, I won't say ideological, the issues are more, I think in recent years the issue has come under the general heading of violence against women. What the feminists have done in the large cities is they have brought to the attention of the media and also to the national leaders, is all sorts of crimes against women. For instance, the dowry deaths and dowry. I mean, those issues would not have gotten the attention they had if there hadn't been very vocal leaders of the women's movement in the large cities bringing these to the forefront.
You spend time in a village with a family of a wealthy family of the higher caste,
right?
Where the woman, the wife, lived in seclusion. It's called purdha.
Right.
What is life like when you live in purdha?
Well, it's not. It's mostly you stay inside your house. It's interesting you say that I lived with a wealthy family. Yes, it was a wealthy family by village standards, but they. This did not mean that she sort of relaxed all day. What she did was she lived in a house that it was a brick house, mud and brick house, and there was all family activity occurred in a sort of a central courtyard that was open to the sky with a mud floor. There was no electricity. There was no running water. The water came from a well, and at night we all ate by firelight. What she did the woman of the house did all day was chores. I never saw her rest. I think I saw her rest briefly in the middle of the day when it was very hot, when everyone else took a rest as well.
When a woman lives in purdha, she's not allowed out of the house?
No, I should say she did not leave the house. She came as far as the front door, and that was it. Now, this was how she spent most of her days. And if you asked her, well, wouldn't you like to go out in the village, she would say, well, why? What's there to see out there? That was sort of her attitude.
What is the explanation for purdha? What is it supposed to accomplish to keep the woman at home?
Well, what it does, among the upper castes in this village, it was just a sign of their status, that they had women, they had enough money that they did not need to have their women work in the fields. and that the women were to be kept inside. It was a great sign of privilege and of status. And it was unthinkable that such a woman would have wandered outside with the lower caste women of the village. And, you know, while you and I can say that's ridiculous, that doesn't make any sense, why don't you just leave the house? It's not so simple. It would never have been done.
My guest is Elizabeth Buemiller. She's a journalist who writes for the Washington Post, and she's the author of the new book, May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons, A Journey Among the Women of India. She lived in India from 1985 to 88. Your take on women in villages is that women in the upper caste are prisoners. They live in purdah, yes, in seclusion, and they can't really leave their house, whereas the peasant women are slaves. They have to work all the time and for next to no money. Is that a fair analysis?
It's strong, but it's what I wrote, so I don't think I'll deny that. I think you're right.
How do you reconcile one of the first countries to have a woman leader, Indira Gandhi, with the conditions that most women put up with in their daily life?
Well, you have to realize that Indira Gandhi came out of a completely different tradition than women in India. I mean, she became prime minister largely because of her father, Jawaharlal Nehru, who was the founding prime minister of India. And her background was very much that of an upper-class, educated woman who had come from a family that expected her to have a profession. She did not do that much directly for women in India, and yet she was of course an enormously powerful symbol. And many women told me that they just felt, you know, that many village women I spoke to said that they thought she was a very good leader, and they couldn't tell me exactly why, but they said, well, she was good because she was a woman. So that was an important factor. But I don't think Indira Gandhi, she was largely irrelevant to the concerns of most Indian women, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, for the time that you were in the cities of India, were most women forced to live in the kind of extreme circumstances of women in villages, or did women have a lot more freedom in the cities?
Well, what's interesting about India is that while there's been this large migration from the villages to the cities in recent years, the ways of the village are still largely followed in the cities, and not the other way around. So certainly there were women in the cities who did not leave their houses very much and go out. But yes, industrialization, urbanization was breaking down a bit of the old ways. And there were jobs in the cities for women in the cities than there were in the villages. So it wasn't quite as repressive in the cities, I would say. Although there was no guarantee if you moved to the city that you would find work, that life would be better.
Journalist Elizabeth Buemiller, her book on the women of India is titled May You Be the Mother of 100 Sons. She's now on maternity leave from the Washington Post and lives in Tokyo with her husband, Stephen Weissman, who reports for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, one of the pioneers in the field of family therapy, Salvador Mnuchin. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet Walter Mosley, the author of the new mystery novel, Devil in a Blue Dress. The hero is a black man. The woman he's paid to find leads him into unfamiliar white territory where everyone is suspicious of him. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews what he calls one of the most moving operas of the 20th century, Benjamin Britten's adaptation of Henry James' Turn of the Screw. And Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte are teamed up again. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Another 48 Hours. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney is ordering the Air Force to remove short-range nuclear attack missiles from its bombers while it studies whether there's a safety problem. The directors of three nuclear weapons laboratories told Congress 2 weeks ago that there is a remote possibility that the missiles could leak plutonium if there were an accident. Russia's parliament today voted to give itself veto power over Soviet laws imposed on its territory. The action came during debate on a declaration of sovereignty to be put to a final vote next week. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Today's vote was an indication of just how widespread the support is for freeing Russia from some of the Soviet government's strict economic and social controls. By a wide margin, the legislature agreed that its laws should take precedence over those of the Soviet Union. But final passage of the full sovereignty declaration is far from assured. If today's vote was a test, the final declaration could lose because it requires endorsement by two-thirds of the parliament, or 156 more than the yes votes cast today. Boris Yeltsin, Russia's new president, made sovereignty the main point of his election campaign last week. Now he'll have to continue campaigning if he's to win a sovereignty endorsement next week. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
After 40 years of communist rule, Czechoslovakia held free elections today. The government newspaper is predicting a 90% voter turnout. A judge in Michigan has issued an order forbidding a doctor from using his so-called suicide machine. On Monday of this week, an Oregon woman suffering from Alzheimer's disease used the device to take her own life, prompting a nationwide debate over the issue of doctor-assisted suicide. Don Gagne reports.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian calls himself the world's first obituarist, that is, a doctor specializing in medically supervised suicide. For now, however, he's been ordered not to use his suicide device again. Prosecutors are investigating the death of the woman who used the invention this week, and they're considering criminal charges against Kevorkian. Oakland County Judge Alice Gilbert has ruled that the doctor's actions raise enough legal questions to warrant the issuance of a temporary restraining order. The ruling did not surprise Dr. Kevorkian, who says the legal and medical communities are attacking him because we live in a society that has an irrational fear of death.
What is wrong with death? It's become an evil name. Even all of us, you're going to face it, you know. Is it so evil to look at what you're going to face? Yeah, because you're afraid. Emotions.
Prosecutors say it may be several months before they decide whether to charge the doctor with any crime. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stock prices ended the day and the week sharply lower, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average closing down 34.95 points at 2862.38. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. The classic Henry James novella, The Turn of the Screw, is one of the creepiest stories in literature. It's been turned into a successful movie and play, and also an opera. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a reissued recording of the opera conducted by its composer, Benjamin Britten.
Who is it? Who? Who? Who can it be? Who? Who can it be?
Benjamin Britten's operatic version of The Turn of the Screw is one of his most brilliant achievements, one of the most beautiful and moving operas of the 20th century. It was composed in 1954, and later that year it had not only its first performance, but also its first and for many years its only recording. It's my favorite among Britten's operas, and this recording is how I got to know it. It's a work that repays repeated hearing. The more you listen, and the haunting melodies and dazzling colors make you want to listen, the more you understand Britten's remarkable technical experiment. Each of the 15 scenes in the opera and the extensive interludes between scenes is a musical variation of an eerie 12-note theme. The Turn of the Screw, in case you've forgotten, is Henry James's tale about the new governess of two precocious children who are having, as it were, intercourse with their former manservant and governess, who both happen to be dead. The subtle and subversive libretto by Mifanwy Piper pits the upright new governess against the seductive ghosts. As in the James story, the young boy, Miles, dies at the end. But in the opera, the governess's desperate obsession with protecting the children from the world of beauty and fantasy that the ghosts represent is equally responsible for the child's destruction. Britten has composed a parable of original sin. To deny our inherent sinful impulses, to repress our natural desire for pleasure, is to destroy what is human in us. In one of Britten's most poignant passages, Miles learns his Latin by singing a little song about the word malo, which has four root meanings: apple or apple tree, prefer, a bad person, and harm. We've all heard the story of what harm can come from a preference for apples. Miles is sung with phenomenal understanding by the very young David Hemmings, the actor who later played the photographer in Antonioni's blow-up. Peter Quint, the alluring apparition, is the extraordinary British tenor Peter Pears, Benjamin Britten's companion, for whom he wrote all of his great tenor roles. How could Miles resist his secret call to explore the hidden world that stirs when the candle is out? The last scene is overwhelming. At the center is the magnificent, heartbreaking soprano Jennifer Vivian. As the governess, she rises to enormous moral stature when she acknowledges her own responsibility. "What have we done between us?" she sings over the dead body of little Miles. In her voice, his Latin lesson becomes a profound lament for all our misguided selves. Oh, It's great to have this recording of the turn of the screw around again. As a conductor, Britten was always his own best advocate. I wonder what Tipper Gore, though, would think of his disturbing message.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Benjamin Britten, conducting The Turn of the Screw, is on London Records. This is Fresh Air. Crime novels have been dominated by white detectives. There's a new entry in the genre that features a black hero. The story is set in Los Angeles in 1948. The main character is Easy Rollins, a World War II veteran who just got laid off from his job at a defense plant for standing up to his boss. Easy is broke, so he accepts an offer from a white gangster to track down a white woman who has a predilection for black men. The search takes Easy into all the black bars he knows, but it also leads him into parts of the white world he's unfamiliar with, people and places that are hostile to a black man. Out of these situations, you get Easy's observations about race in America. The novel is called Devil in a Blue Dress. It's the first book by my guest Walter Mosley. Mosley is in his late 30s, grew up in Los Angeles, and now lives in New York. This is the opening of Devil in a Blue Dress.
I was surprised to see a white man walk into Joppy's bar. It's not just that he was white, but he wore an off-white linen suit and shirt with a Panama straw hat and bone shoes over flashing white silk socks. His skin was smooth and pale with just a few freckles. One lick of strawberry blonde hair escaped the band of his hat. He stopped in the doorway, filling it with his large frame, and surveyed the room with pale eyes, not a color I'd ever seen in a man's eyes. When he looked at me, I felt a thrill of fear, but that went away quickly because I was used to white people by 1948. I had spent 5 years with white men and women from Africa to Italy, through Paris and into the fatherland itself. I ate with them and slept with them, and I killed enough blue-eyed young men to know that they were just as afraid to die as I was.
Now, your novel's set in 1948, which is around 4 years before you were born.
Yeah.
This is based on stories your father told you? I don't mean the story of the novel, but the setting, the period.
Yeah, the idea is when I was a little kid, maybe five, six, seven, I would be with my father and his friends, and they would tell stories which really kind of came into my heart. I mean, you know, when you're a little kid and you listen to these wild stories that people are telling, they become part of you. So it's like I was alive then, in a way.
What were most of the stories about?
Most of the stories are about survival and having a good time. I think most of the stories are about how hard life was and how enjoyable life was. You know, a story once my father told me he was in a bar with his wife and his cousin. And some guy was bothering his wife. And my father, as a young man, pulls a knife on this guy. And my cousin grabbed the knife out of his hand because she said that if she killed the guy, she could get out of trouble by morning. And she tried to stab the guy, and she stabbed my father instead in the leg.
Jeez.
That was funny. But, like, she was there, and my father was there, and they were all laughing about it, and it was, like, a great time. So I thought it was wonderful.
How did she plan, by the way, to get out of trouble if she killed the guy?
There was an idea, at least, that she had that if a man attacked a black woman or had a fight with a black woman, a black man, that the judge wouldn't worry about it, just let him go in Houston. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what they thought.
Now, your character of Easy Rollins fought in World War II, and that's where he was first really around a lot of other white men. Did your father fight in the war?
He was in the war. He was in World War II. He was in Europe. But most black soldiers really didn't have to fight in the war. You could if you wanted to, but you had to volunteer, really. So he was never, he was in the statistics unit, and he never did fight.
Did the experience mean as much to your father as it did in to the life of your character of Easy Rollins?
Yeah, I think so. I think in that way, Easy reflects my father. My father, when he returned to Houston, found that more of his friends in the war had survived than friends who had lived in Houston. People were killed, died of various diseases, and weren't nearly as well taken care of in Houston, Texas, as they were in Europe fighting. So he decided that it wasn't good to live in Houston, so he went to Los Angeles.
Wow. Was there an equivalent of the war in terms of an experience or something that exposed you to the white world? Or did you just grow up in a racially mixed world, unlike your father?
Yeah, my mother's white. And I've always been in a racially mixed world. But a lot of the people that I was with, it was new to them, or always new to them. Like white people who had only been around white people most of their lives and most of their important experiences, so had trouble with black people, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Although your mother was white and your father was black, when you were outside of the family, did people just see you as black as opposed to, you know, being of a mixed background?
Well, yeah. I mean, in America, you're black if you're at all black, right? I mean, there's not really too much difference between being half black or a quarter black and all black. I mean, you are if you are.
There's a scene where Easy gets arrested by cops and he says, well, he's played the game of cops and nigger before. What's the game?
Well, the game is not giving up information, basically. That they're going to have an attitude that you did something wrong. And that's not going to change. And so you're going to have to continually say, I didn't do it, I'm not wrong, and they're going to continually say that you are, and you just have to weather that. I've experienced that. I got stopped by a policeman in Los Angeles, in the hills, and the guy actually pulled a gun on me and asked me, did I break into this building that was standing there? And I had to keep saying no, and he kept holding his gun on me, saying, I know you did it. Now all you have to do is tell me. And I was so nervous, but it finally just kind of went away after a while.
It's hard to convince someone that you're innocent when they're certain that you're guilty.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's kind of hard to convince yourself, actually. You know, when there's enough pressure to say you're guilty, you feel, well, I'll be safe if I say I'm guilty. He won't shoot me if I do that, or he won't hit me, or he won't put me in jail. Then maybe I'll just say that. But, of course, that doesn't work either.
You know, without giving away too much about your novel, I will say that one character in it is of mixed background.
Mm-hmm.
Like you are, but they are really screwed up.
Yeah.
I mean, they cannot handle being part white and part black.
Yeah.
Did you have friends like that who really couldn't handle it?
Well, it's an interesting thing when the idea of being a mulatto in America, because what I said before, externally people see you as being black, but internally, of course, you identify with people who you're close to and you loved. I've been very close to my mother's side of the family as well as my father's. So there's a kind of an alienation you feel from almost everyone, because you'll find, or at least I found when I was growing up, that a lot of black people felt that white people were different, not the same. And that's not something I ever felt. I said, well, you know, white people are like me, because these are people I've known my whole life. So, and as far as that's concerned, yes, I identify with the character that you're talking about in the book.
But did you know someone who really kind of went over the edge because they couldn't handle it?
No, I don't know anybody personally who has. Mm-hmm. You know, only stories of people, you know, people who passed for white, people who just didn't want to be black.
So what's going to happen in your sequel?
Well, my idea for this series of books is to write 6 Easy Rollins mysteries. And they'll be separated by decades, more or less. One in the 40s, one in the 50s, two in the 60s, one in the 70s, one in the 80s. And Easy, of course, is going to get old. People around him are going to die. And he's going to go through various periods of, you know, political and social change. The next book happens in 1952, and it's going to be at least partially about the McCarthy era. about, you know, chasing down communists and how lower class black people relate to this kind of the idea of communism and the country in general.
So this series, in a way, is a chance for you to investigate parts of the past that you either didn't live through or were very young when it was happening, or you lived through but you were a completely different age than the perspective you're writing from.
Right. No, it's you know, the past is an interesting, the recent past or history is an interesting thing because you live through it because people you know live through it. And this past informed their lives and they informed your life. So it's me dealing with kind of pure emotions that I experienced through my father and my friends, etc.
Is your father still alive?
Yeah. My parents are both alive.
I wonder, since the book seems in a way like, well, an almost homage to your father, I mean, because there seems to be a lot of the stories he told in there. What he thinks of the book?
Well, he likes the book, actually. Though, it's very funny. I was talking to him a few months ago when he first read it, and he asked me, seriously, I think he says, well, Walter, where am I in this book? And I thought it was so funny. Because I told him, I said, well, you know, a lot has to do with, you know, your history, your background and stuff. But he couldn't notice it, and I thought that was very funny.
Well, I thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay. Thank you, too.
Walter Mosley's new novel, Devil in a Blue Dress, will be published June 25th by Norton. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're doing at All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing today from Moscow about the action of the Russian Parliament, that's the legislature of the Russian Soviet Republic, which asserted that its laws are more important than those of the laws of the Soviet Union, the national laws. And that step is quite important. We'll find out what it might mean for the future of the Soviet Union. Also, a new study on the world environment shows that deforestation is taking place faster than we thought, and the developing countries are contributing to more greenhouse gases than you might think. And also the remarkable recovery of the treaty oak in Austin, Texas.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The sequel to the movie 48 Hours has arrived. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Is my memory deceiving me, or am I right in thinking that 48 Hours, I mean the original 1982 version, had some sharp, funny dialogue, and that Eddie Murphy, in his film debut, delivered it with a refreshing amount of sass? The laughs 8 years ago came from Murphy's burlesque of what it meant to be a black man in a white man's world. Murphy's performance somehow managed to acknowledge white sensibilities and turn them on their heads at the same time. In another 48 Hours, the laughs don't come from Murphy's wit or the screenplay's wit or from anywhere, really. The ones I heard in the theater invariably arrived when someone got unexpectedly punched or shot, always with the accompaniment of explosive noise on the soundtrack. This movie is an orgy of sodden macho attitudinizing. It's all about big, nasty guys with deep voices being menaced by bigger, nastier guys with even deeper voices and bigger guns. In this picture, size counts. Meanwhile, the plot dies of sequelitis. Remember how in the first 48 hours, the renegade cop played by Nick Nolte had to spring Eddie Murphy from jail in order to catch Murphy's old partner in crime, a crazed killer? Well, now that crazed killer's brother has come to town with his biker friends, and he wants to kill Murphy and Nolte both. And besides, he's been hired to do the dirty work of a mysterious drug dealer called the Iceman. The moment Murphy is released from jail, this new gang of goons is hot on his trail, and so's Nolte, who wants Murphy's help in tracking them and the Iceman down. Murphy, of course, would rather just get on with his life, although in this scene, he can't help but notice Nolte's slightly used bulletproof vest.
If you're looking for sympathy, you come to the wrong person, okay? I'm supposed to be on my way to Florida to be in my uncle's used car business. Instead, I'm here with you. I'm broke. I've been shot at. I was in a bus that flipped over 20 times, had glass all in my hair and all over my suit, broke my Walkman and lost my James Brown tape. So leave me alone, okay, Jack?
Well, life's tough, Reggie. I ran into your friends, too, today. They shot me in the chest 6 times.
Well, you don't look bad for a dead person.
I would be if it wasn't for one of these.
Why'd you wear this anyway?
Well, I knew I was going to see you, Reggie. Now, I wouldn't want to get killed by a stray bullet that was meant for you. Now, that'd be a hell of a way to go, wouldn't it be?
They're good, these actors. Murphy's latest movies have been such ghastly ego wallows that it's refreshing to see him play opposite someone like Nolte, who can hold the screen in his own right. He doesn't have much in the way of dialogue to work with, but Murphy gives a cooler, less self-adoring performance than we've seen from him in a long time. Nolte, meanwhile, does what he can with the wheezing cliches of renegade copdom, but there are moments when he seems just plain uncomfortable, when he looks as though he knows he's just playing straight man to a superstar. The director, Walter Hill, is a past master of He-Man bloodletting. He can film a shootout or a car chase faster and louder and with trickier angles than almost anybody in Hollywood. And in two of his scenes, a hotel showdown and a gunfight in the middle of a motorcycle race, he outdoes himself. Elsewhere, though, his stuff is all show and no tell, crazy shots that confuse when they need to clarify, and a climax that's so full of flying glass and weird lighting and slow motion that you feel as though you're watching it from the bottom of a swimming pool. What's it all for? Another 48 hours means to give us a nasty good time, but nastiness isn't in and of itself fun, not when it's unalleviated by humor, character, or diverting storytelling. This movie feels brutish and bloated and weary, as if it had OD'd on something, most likely testosterone.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. It's all edited and mixed by Roberta Sherrock, Joan Tuohy, and Allison Dufty. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet one of the founders of family therapy, psychiatrist Salvador Mnuchin. Also, the story behind a horror film that's back from the dead. We talk with the writer and director of the cult film Carnival of Souls. It just came out on home video. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.